The common wisdom is that we're getting more violent all the time. Witness the genocides and world wars of the last century. But cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker says we have it all wrong. And in his 800-page book, The Better Angels of Ourselves, he makes the case for how violence has declined. Tribal warfare was actually 9 times more deadly than war and genocide in the 20th century. The murder rate of medieval Europe was more than 30 times what it is today. Slavery, sadistic punishment, and gruesome executions were common parts of life for millennia. Then, they were mostly abolished. Wars between developed countries have vanished. Even in the developing world, wars kill a fraction of the people they did a few decades ago. Rape, battering, hate crimes, deadly riots, child abuse, cruelty to animals, all down. Steve Paulson asked Pinker, why?
In terms of reducing day-to-day violence, both the insult that escalates into a lethal quarrel or the raiding of a neighboring village to abduct the women and kill the men, that has been driven down by the control of government. When you've got a third party that wants to keep the peace within its kingdom, not for any particularly benevolent reasons, but just because violence among citizens is kind of a nuisance to a king who'd rather keep them alive to supply him with taxes and soldiers. But that pacification of a population will drive violence down. And then as a government evolves to a more democratic form, you have the government acting as a third-party dispute resolver through the court system and laws. And instead of having to defend your interests the way the Corleones did by the threat of violence carried out to make it credible, you call the police, you file a lawsuit, and that results in fewer bodies on the floor.
So you're saying it's partly the rise of the nation state. This has contributed to the decline of violence.
Certainly the rise of the state. Yes, states and empires, not necessarily nation states. But the rise of government tends to reduce the rate of lethal quarreling among its citizens. There's also the rise of instruments of commerce, money, contracts, interest, technologies of trade like roads and canals that make it more valuable to buy and sell what you want than to plunder it. And there are a number of reasons to think that the rise of commerce has led to a decline in warfare and violence. Also, I think the rise of education and literacy and cosmopolitanism and knowledge and open free speech have tended to drive down forms of institutionalized violence, partly because people get into the habit of seeing the world from other people's point of view, and that makes it a little easier to empathize with them, a little harder to brutalize with them if you imagine what life is like from their point of view. And the rise of a general intellectual attitude towards social practices. Can we justify what we're doing, or do we have to defend it in argument? And do the people in power have to defend what they do? When you start to have widespread literacy, a free press, people will start to question whether slavery can really be justified, or mutilating people as a form of punishment, or having public executions. And practice after practice fell when people started to scrutinize them, debate them. The debates caught on. They would embroil people in coffee houses and pubs, and then eventually the politicians who would sign measures into law.
Okay, you've mentioned a whole bunch of things here, and I want to sort of pick up a few of them. Coming back to the state, the government, which now often has more power than it used to in previous years, it seems that you could make a different argument, which is that with the rise of the nation state, it is actually much easier to engineer mass killings. Nazi extermination of the Jews or Chairman Mao's eradication of his political enemies during the Cultural Revolution. In other words, maybe there are less frequent violent outbursts, but when they do happen, they're deadlier.
They can be, although it's misleading. If you're talking about the effect of government as a whole over the course of history, and there have been thousands of them, to pick the two or three worst ones gives you a misleading picture of the role of government in general compared to anarchy.
One of the points that you make in your book is you credit the Enlightenment with some of this more humanistic way of treating our fellow neighbors. And I want to talk about that legacy a bit. The Enlightenment, of course, the dawn of the age of reason, I guess you could say, and to counteract old religious attitudes. How far can we take this to explain this new era of at least more peacefulness?
I think it has profound effect. For one thing, around the time of the Enlightenment, you see a wave of reforms designed to eliminate some of the institutionalized barbaric practices. That's when governments stopped burning people alive or breaking them on the wheel or disemboweling them in public as a form of punishment. Our own Eighth Amendment, with its prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment, is just an example of what happened during that slice of history. The abolition movement, the abolition of slavery, was another gift of the Enlightenment. It used to be legal everywhere in the world. Around the time of the Enlightenment, there was a domino of abolitions that eventually swept across the entire globe. Debtors' prisons, blood sports, absolute despots who could kill on a whim. All of those were questioned during the Enlightenment. Cruelty to animals, persecution of homosexuals. They didn't all take effect in the second half of the 18th century. Some of them did, and some of them, the ideas had to bide their time while more destructive ideologies took over. But then they reappeared in the 20th century, and the arguments for human rights that we've put into practice very much go back to the time of Kant and Locke and Hume and Adam Smith and the American framers several hundred years ago.
It seems that there is a profound philosophical question at the heart of this, and that is whether we become better human beings, better in terms of being more compassionate, because of our powers of reason, of coming up with rational underpinnings for moral codes, or whether we act kindly towards other people for more emotional reasons, perhaps because we have been led to think this way through religious upbringing.
You're right that there is an interesting back and forth between the head and the heart, if you will. That is, do we refrain from cruel and destructive practices because we have compassion and empathy for the victims, or because we have a commitment to ideas like universal human rights that don't justify or don't permit the exploitation of other living things? It's very hard to know which came first, but I do think they go back and forth and they can reinforce each other. I don't think it can just be empathy, because quite frankly, I don't think that anyone can literally feel the pain of everyone else on Earth. Maybe I'm a bad person, but I just don't spend that many hours of the day imagining what it's like to be a starving person in South Asia or a victim of war in Africa. On the other hand, I firmly believe that anything that we can do to alleviate hunger and war ought to be implemented. I think that there's no other position can be defended morally, and I'm willing to put it into practice in terms of support for policies, charitable donations. Historically, you see moralistic arguments like how awful it was to be a slave and have a child pulled out of his mother's arms by a cruel slaveholder. But you can also have arguments saying, what right does one person have to own another person? I think they've both been influential. If anything, I would tend to put my bets on the intellectual side, the power of ideas, that one often sees in the history of the abolition of barbaric practices, that it started with briefs from philosophers of the day that then went viral. The pamphlets were distributed, the books sold out, they were translated into every other European language. They were the subject of arguments in the coffee houses and bars and salons and dinner tables, and eventually influenced the decision makers. They probably needed a push of compassion, of sympathetic imagination. What is it like to be an animal who is mistreated? What is it like to be a slave? What is it like to be a child? But the ideas definitely had a huge, powerful influence.
Are you saying humanity is making moral progress? I mean, we're basically becoming better as a species?
Yeah, not that we're – I don't think we've become biologically any better. I don't think that this is a case of Darwinian evolution. But I think our collective global culture has been moving in that direction.
And to speculate into the future then, I mean, if you are right and we are becoming kinder, more compassionate, do you think our moral codes will develop even further?
I suspect they will in many directions. I think that our treatment of farm animals is going to improve. I think that violence against women and children worldwide is going to get better now that it's the target both of shaming campaigns from above and grassroots pressure from below. I think the tolerance of despots and brutal dictators is going to lessen. I think the idea of war between developed countries, which is already pretty much on the way out, is going to become consolidated. That still leaves a number of forms of violence that could still occur. There could still be civil wars. There could still be terrorism. There could still be crime. But to the extent that we can control things by our own decisions, such as the treatment of farm animals, I think that the humanitarian currents will continue.
Steven Pinker is the author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. Steve Paulson spoke with him.